Michigan has hundreds of ghost towns, communities that fell apart when there were no longer jobs or a reason to stay. In the Upper Peninsula, such places were often tied to mining. One reason that so many ghost towns dot the Keweenaw, where copper was king in the latter half of the 19th century. One copper town that virtually disappeared when the mine played out was named Central, and it's being partly restored by the Keweenaw County Historical Society. We'll learn more about Central and other ghost towns, what they mean for us today, and what it's like to restore one, just ahead on Media Meet. Hello and welcome to WNMU's Media Meet. I'm Bill Hart. Our guests are Keweenaw County Historical Society President Larry Malloy, Historical Society Trustee Mike Cooper, and Northern Michigan University Emeritus Professor of History Russell Maniagi. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's get some information on the organizations and expertise represented. Larry, you're president of the Keweenaw County Historical Society. Can you tell us something about yourself, your interest in local history, and about the organization?
Well, I probably should confess to start off, I'm a troll.
Okay.
I'm actually from downstate. Mm-hmm. My father brought us up to the Copper Country, to Fort Wilkins, to see the bears when I was a child. So that tells you how long ago it's been that I've been coming to the Copper Country. Fell in love with the place, began to do some writing, began to do some research, and wonder about what are all those big, magnificent cement foundations that are up there. And one thing led to another, got involved in doing some presentations, some writing. And then because I couldn't say no fast enough, became president of the Keweenaw County Historical Society.
All right. The Historical Society is all or largely volunteers, I understand it. What can you tell us about the membership?
We are one of the largest historical societies in the state of Michigan.
Really?
We have approximately 1,200 members in 34 states and four foreign countries. And with the exception of someone that cuts the grass, we're pretty much an all-volunteer organization. Okay. We have 11 museums on 8 different sites.
Wow. Mike, you're an Historical Society trustee and share site manager responsibilities at Central with your wife, Sylvia. Something on your background, please, along with your interest in local history and this organization.
Well, one of my great-grandfathers worked for Detroit and Lake Superior Smelting, and he was sent up to the Copper Country in 1889 to help develop a smelter up here. So he instilled a love both of the country and the history in all of his descendants. I started coming up to the Copper Country as a child for vacations, and a typical afternoon activity would be a tramp around with my grandfather to mining sites or identifying plants. This influenced me deeply as I took a career in the earth sciences, and now that I'm retired, I can live up here and study the history a little more deeply, try and restore and publicize some of the sites.
Okay. Russ, you're an historian with some 200 articles, monographs, and books to your credit, one, A History of the UP, currently available, and as many papers and presentations. As a professor and department head at NMU, you were also university historian and headed the Center for UP Studies. What do we know about ghost towns in the Upper Peninsula, and how do you view their historic significance to the region?
Well, you find that the UP is kind of crisscrossed with ghost towns, not only in the Copper Country, but the Iron Ranges and then other areas. And a few of the outstanding ones that people would be familiar with, Fayette State Park,
sure,
which was a furnace town, Victoria, which was a mining town in the western UP, and Fort Wilkins up at Copper Harbor. So those are some of the outstanding ones. You also find, as you travel around, you'll find maybe old buildings, a lot of foundations. And the other thing you'll find that's kind of curious, you'll find lilac and rose bushes and apple trees. And if you look around, when you see some of those, you look around, you'll find some foundations. So across the UP, you have a whole variety of sites that you could kind of lump together as ghost towns.
Okay. And those were Was this bunch of towns all that significant, or was this just part of the process of settlement?
It'd be most of them are just connected with the process of settlement, mm-hmm. and so there's a number of are significant. Central, for instance, would yes. be in some of the towns up there because they were started at the kind of the beginning of copper mining.
Okay.
And you have, for instance, you have what I would almost consider a city, but it's officially a village, Calumet. And that has, it's down to about 600 people. So you could almost put that into kind of a ghost town category from what it was.
Because at one time it was probably as big as Detroit, right? Something like
well,
that.
Well, maybe not that large, but
I don't mean
10,
Detroit,
about 10, but yeah, but I mean a major, yeah. A major community.
Okay.
Yeah.
Keweenaw is the northernmost county in Michigan and the smallest in population. Central was once the site of a very productive copper mine and homed over 1,200 people. The mine opened in 1854, shut down in 1898 after producing some 27 tons of copper. That's a lot. The Keweenaw is known for a lot of historic sites and locations. Why the commitment to this one?
At the time that the Historical Society got involved, there were still a number of buildings on site, primarily used as hunting camps, to be honest.
Okay.
But we had about 12 different buildings that we knew we could actually purchase and rehab. In addition to that, there's a church in the middle of the town that has been used for an annual central reunion since 1907. So there's a pool of people that at least on the last Sunday of each July, several hundred people will show up at Central and come to the Central Reunion. So when the Historical Society had a chance to kind of parley the buildings that were there plus the people that were already coming, mm-hmm. it made a perfect spot to begin to develop places for discussing life in the early copper range.
Okay. The setting for Central is beautiful. It's now fairly lush with broad vistas, a beautiful view of a valley there. Can you describe it and its location in more detail, the actual layout of the town? Sort of. Go ahead.
Well, it's at the base of a large bluff, the greenstone basalt flow, that is also the source or the setting for a number of other mines, like the Cliff, the St. Clair Northwestern. Central was located along the Mineral Range Road, which ran from Copper Harbor to Calumet. The town basically consists of two perpendicular roads with the buildings that developed on them and just off of them on footpaths. The mining buildings are all gone now, but we have 10 of the original buildings still standing, 10 of the original houses and one barn still standing from them. But it's just scattered houses with a lot of abandoned foundations in between them at the moment. Beautiful place for a walk.
At some point, the Historical Society, well, 1996, you acquired over 30 acres on up to 38 acres in and around Central.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Actually, they started a fund called A Penny a Pound, and they had a fundraising campaign to donate money to buy the land at Central.
Okay.
It was a very successful campaign. Again, a lot of people felt that this was one of the last places we could actually purchase and restore back to some of its original glory, and that's what we've tried to do.
I see. A school often becomes central to municipal stability and progress, and unfortunately the school at Central was gone by the time you got there, probably.
Yes.
Tell us about that school.
Go ahead, Mike.
Well, it was built in 1878. Mm-hmm. It was a three-story building. Two classrooms on each of the first two floors. The third floor was a hall, both used for school programs as well as community programs or band concerts. They had typically 3 to 5 teachers and as many as 350 students. During the peak years of the mine, which would have been the 1880s. Yeah. After the mine closed around the turn of the century, the school closed shortly thereafter. But it was a beautiful building. They were
beautiful.
Very proud.
Set on a hill.
Of their
Central.
Set up on a hill outside of town. The story is, because the mine worked 24 hours a day, there were night workers and hence day sleepers, and they wanted the noise of the school children away from town, up on the hill, so the miners could sleep.
Okay. The Central probably would have become hard to locate. What drew the society to it, to that location?
I think the fact that there are still a number of people in the Copper Country that have primarily Cornish roots,
okay,
that still feel kind of an ancestral relationship to the town of Central. At the Central Reunion, it's one of the things that we do every year at the reunion, is to actually have people that have relatives that lived or worked at Central call out their family names. And for me, as a troll, as someone who got involved in history relatively late, it's always been very impressive to sit at that Central Reunion service and hear the names of the families that settled the town and that their relatives are coming back.
Okay.
And so it just made kind of a natural natural path for the society to try to encourage the development of the town.
Okay.
In addition to that, there are a lot of people of our generation who played there as children.
Really?
Their ancestors might have rented one of these old abandoned houses as a hunting camp or a summer camp, and they would bring the family out. So kids would have been exploring all these old ruins as they grew up in the 40s and 50s.
Right. The site now has a visitor center and some carefully reconstructed homes. Tell us a little bit about how the visitor center came about. That's kind of a big step, isn't it, in setting up one of these sites?
Well, that was one of the first buildings that was rehabilitated when they first bought it, and we have pictures of what it looked like. They were so afraid it was going to simply collapse, they wrapped it in phone wire to keep it standing upright for the first winter. But we fortunately have a very good restoration carpenter, and he set to work on it. We have the original floorboards, 22-inch wide pine. Saw marks still in them, you can see. We've been able to obtain photographs of the mine, both as it was working in the 1880s, about 1900 when it closed, and in the 1930s, after it had been abandoned for 30 years or so. You can see the degradation of the buildings and the encroachment of plants on it during this time. We've also created a video that features both the musical life of the Cornish miners and the life of one woman who became a widower at Central and proceeded to raise her five children there by making hats and dresses for the women, selling candy and tobacco products. Okay. So there was a variety of people and lives going on at Central. We've tried to capture a little bit of that in the visitor center, but that's a good place to start your trip.
Okay. Once acquired, were there tours of Central immediately, or did that have to wait a while until you got
that? Had to wait a little while,
mm-hmm,
until we had the other buildings actually stabilized so the people could actually go through them. The process of stabilizing the buildings has not always been an easy one. Mike mentioned the 22-inch floorboards. When we actually got the visitor center, you could see where they were worn down. So our carpenter literally flipped the boards over. So now when you walk into the visitor center, you can see the marks from the saws. We've had people actually walk in and tell us exactly how big that saw blade was based on the marks of the cut of the floorboard. We had a building, house number 25, right up the hill from the church that literally was sliding, had slid off its foundation. Mm-hmm. And I think it was 2 or 3 years it took. They hooked come-alongs to it, pulled it up a bit, let it sit, came back a little while later, pulled it up, and literally brought that building up the hill and dropped it back on its original foundation. Okay. So it takes a while to get an old town back into shape that you actually want people to feel comfortable walking through the buildings and feel secure.
Sure. In terms of development or restoration, how did you decide on what you wanted to accomplish? And what's the plan at this point, you know?
Well, when I took over as site coordinator here, they had two buildings set up as exhibit buildings plus the visitor center, and one building being used as rental properties, as a rental property. Since then, we have finished one more building to use as short-term rentals as a way of gaining some cash flow for further work, and we're working on two more buildings. One is almost completed. The plan is to call it the Central Creative Center. It's going to serve as a residence for someone doing interpretive or artistic work at Central. It may be fine arts with painting or poetry. It may be an archaeologist mapping these foundations I've talked about. But we want to provide a space for people to study Central, and we hope that they will in turn give presentations and attract more of the public to come out and see Central. I'm always surprised at how many local residents may stop by and say, I had no idea this was all here. They're unaware of some of the roots to the local heritage, and we want to try and fix that.
All right. We're talking about the partial restoration of Central by the Keweenaw County Historical Society with Keweenaw County Historical Society President Larry Malloy, Historical Society Trustee Mike Cooper, and Northern Michigan University Emeritus Professor of History Russell Manyagi. How do you pay for the project?
Aside from begging for money? Actually, we've been very lucky. We have very generous donors who are members of the society. We work together with the Keweenaw National Historical Park in Calumet. Their advisory commission has a grant program, and we've been lucky to get some of the grants for some of our sites to do some of the restoration work at different sites. We've applied for other grants. Money is always an issue in an old building, not just to restore it, but we need roofs all the time. We constantly are re-roofing buildings at Central.
Yeah, to restore a building, it costs between $40,000 and $50,000. Some of this comes out of the general fund of the Historical Society. I've fine-honed my pitch to ask for money when I'm a docent in the Visitor Center. Okay. We've started putting on a fundraiser. It turns out to be a lot of fun to have a jazz concert under the stars. We do this, it'll be on August 10th this year, and so far we've been lucky. It's rained before the concerts, after the concerts, but never on the concerts. So we've been very lucky that way. But it's just a fun evening to come out. So if people want to do that and contribute a little. Otherwise, as Larry said, we do get grants. Portage Health has contributed a grant to develop more hiking trails. And we're going to try and develop trails wide enough that can be used both for hiking and cross-country skiing, snowshoeing. So try and draw people out there in more seasons as well.
All right. The Keweenaw's first successful mine, the Cliff Mine, opened in 1845 in Clifton near Phoenix, both abandoned by the turn of the century. While both mining towns, the populations differed. They were both mining towns, but they differed a little bit from Central, I think. The church in Clifton included, churches in Clifton included a Catholic and an Episcopal church. And the main church in Central was Methodist. Churches in small towns were no small matter in those days. What might the different denominations tell us in this case, Russ, you think?
Well, you're going to find that the Catholic Church would indicate almost immediately the earliest settlers that were up there, French Canadians, Germans, Irish.
Okay.
And the Methodist Church would indicate Cornish. Later on at other towns and so on, as you got Scandinavians coming in and Finns, Scandinavians, you would get Lutheran churches developing. So by knowing the different denominations, you can almost immediately tie into the ethnic population there.
I see. Timber and mining would build the UP. What was the distribution of populations as newcomers settled in the region in the 19th century?
Well, the thing you have to remember, mining was not an occupation that attracted native-born American boys.
Okay.
And so it was a dangerous job. It was a difficult job. It
took some skill too, right?
And took skill. Americans were experience. Not into really into mining until after this time and the California Gold Rush and so on, the Western development. And so they just took people off the boat. And there were European immigrants wanted to come to the United States for the economic potential, and they basically took them off the boat, put them on a train, and said, you're going north. You had some interesting stories of people traveling on the train and thinking they were on the way to nowhere, not realizing, they're coming from relatively small European towns, and all of a sudden they're traveling for hours and hours and never getting to their destination.
It's said that visitors to Central found it difficult to understand the residents, as the cousin Jacks included Cornish in their speech. I don't know if it was something like a patois or whether they were just speaking Cornish. Was that common in UP mining towns or small towns generally that one language would kind of dominate? There wasn't English.
You know? No, the Cornish, you have to remember, Cornish is a separate language. It's not like a spin-off of English.
Okay.
So if you know English, you're going to know Cornish.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different language. And the last native Cornish speaker, I think, died around 1898. So a lot of the people that came over in the 1840s were still coming from that linguistic background.
Mm-hmm.
And I have run across people attacking the Cornish and their speech, and I thought this was kind of strange. They're English people. But you can just imagine, and I'll kind of point this out.
Uh-huh.
For instance, for some reason, they would put H's in front of vowels. An orange would become a horange.
Orange, okay.
And then they would drop the consonant so that home became om. Now, just think about talking to somebody that is talking that way, adding consonants or removing them.
And they're doing it automatically, too.
And then then the syntax of the language and so on is going to, so they would be speaking English, but the words are going to be in a different. And so that was what you'd find. You'd also find that in the towns in 1917, as we were getting into World War I, National Geographic magazine had an article about immigrants and so on,
mm-hmm.
and they pointed out that Calumet was one of the most foreign cities in the country, or small
sure.
city in the
mm-hmm.
country, where you could hear dozens of languages, but very little English. and it was, and of all the, you know, all the towns they could have gone to, they went and pulled out Calumet. So you would find that the foreign language would be used in churches, sermons, mm-hmm. and so on, newspapers, journals. So it was widespread. So you'd have different languages in the different towns. Now, if you had a collection of one ethnic group, that would, you know, like the Cornish, that would predominate.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a forgotten connection to copper mining in the UP that helped make it possible. I'm told that Central was mined by Native Americans well before the settlements, and their discoveries were eventually exploited by Central Mine and other companies. That's one of the ways they found the body. Is that right? The vein?
Exactly right. Native Americans first occupied this area just after the glaciers came through, so they saw a very different landscape. No forests, no trees. The copper, veins of it would be just sticking up out of the ground. They'd see these massive pieces of copper, and then they would start mining them simply by bashing them with hammer stones to try and get small bits of copper for making fish hooks, awls, decorative items, things like that. And so the white prospectors, the Anglos, quickly learned that if you could find one of these Indian depressions in the hammer stones, that indicated a good supply of copper, it was worth exploring. And that's what happened at Central. Agents from the Cliff Mine, about 6 miles down the road, mm-hmm. formed about 10 years earlier, were exploring there, found this vein sticking out, bought that property from the Northwestern mine that were busy developing other prospects and opened up Central. They happened to draw the luckier card and a much more significant ore deposit than the Northwestern was working.
Wow. And it was long and deep as well, right?
Yes, down at least 3,000 feet in their deepest shaft.
For most visitors, I imagine homes are the key when they visit Central. Some actually feature period decor, from
yes.
furniture to lace tablecloths, china, beds, clothing, even rudimentary appliances, I've noted, and some stuff on the walls, like a marriage certificate that was pretty enough to put on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
What was the lifestyle of a mining family in Central's heyday?
In the summer or the winter?
Oh, okay.
Because obviously there's a big difference in the town. Small town life, the school and the church, the focus of the community, in the home, obviously not prepared food, making your own bread, etc.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of fishing, a lot of hunting for game. In the winter, though, when things got cold, these houses weren't insulated. So they would pour sawdust down the walls. They would actually put sawdust in front of some of the windows so mm-hmm. that where you had sunlight in the summer, in the winter, you would not have as much sunlight. You also had, as Mike mentioned, day, night shift workers sharing the same house. So the woman of the house had the unofficial, official job of making food for both day and night shift, for taking care of the laundry for the men that were living in the, renting rooms in the house and things like that. So it was a rather rough life.
Okay. And were they cut off in the winter?
You know, they actually, they had limited transportation because of the snow. But we have records showing that the choir, for example, in Central, went and competed against the choir over in Eagle River. They had choir okay. competitions between the towns. So limited transportation, but not totally isolated. But truly, once the last boat came in the fall, they were stuck until the next spring in terms of supplies and things like that.
You couldn't okay. get, other than what they'd stored in the warehouses, yeah. but they didn't have to plow their roads. They just panked them and then took sleds over yeah. them. So one of the most common relics we have, in fact, are small cutter sleds that people have hung on to, for the equivalent of baby carriages in the winter. And this, you can see how they would have used these just on the packed down snow to yeah. move around the town, at least.
Okay. I've heard it said, by the way, that the home displays at Central are as good as those found in major museums. And the way they're collected and displayed to provide some security and the ability of people to see them well, I think was very well done. Now, such things are traditionally handed down, then eventually find their way into the hands of strangers, so they must have been tough to acquire. How did you get them?
People just, a variety of ways, but basically people discover things in their attic when they're moving, cleaning out, and they simply don't want them anymore, but realize there is value. This was their family's heritage. They'd like it to go someplace that it can be seen and appreciated by others. That's typically how we get the things, and they're still coming in.
Okay. We've been talking about the Village of Central and the partial restoration by the Keweenaw County Historical Society with Keweenaw County Historical Society President Larry Malloy, Historical Society Trustee Mike Cooper, and Northern Michigan University Emeritus Professor of History Russell Benyagi. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Bill Hart. Thanks for joining us on Media Meet.
The preceding program was produced in studios located in the Edgar L. Hardin Learning Resources Center by WNMU-TV, Northern Michigan University Public Television.